If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Throughout our history as a species, we've been accompanied by germs and parasites. From the dangers of the plague to the spread of smallpox, infectious diseases have posed a deadly threat to humans for millennia. Our section editor, Rhiannon Davies, spoke to Kyle Harper, author of a new book on the history of infectious disease, Plagues Upon the Earth, about how parasites have shaped our past.
The first question I wanted to ask you is, you argue that our history as a species is inseparable from the history of germs and parasites. Why is this?
Well, I think one way to try and look at human history is in the same way that a natural scientist might look at the history of any other organism or species. We just happen to have a very eventful history that's driven by a cumulative culture-driven change. So when we talk about human history in the very big picture, we mean things like the rise of farming, the domestication of animals, the rise of cities, the creation of huge trading networks and transportation technologies like ships that can cross oceans, railroads, steamships, now jet planes. Every one of these inventions, one of these technological innovations in human history has consequences for human health. And more specifically, every one of these technological innovations that changes the way we live changes the kinds of germs that we have. And so I think one of the great themes in human history is the relationship between the way we change the planet, the physical environment in which we live, and the way in which the evolution of pathogens responds to those changes. And so the great diseases throughout human history, measles, smallpox, plague, malaria, tuberculosis, are all, in a sense, evolutionary responses to the way that humans live and the way that we change the environments around us.
I'm going right back now to when our ancestors first made fire. How did this have an impact on infectious disease? What happened then?
Well, in a lot of ways, fire is a technology that makes us human. It actually is controlled, or the discovery of how to control fire actually predates Homo sapiens. It goes back into earlier hominin ancestors, probably Homo erectus, learned to control fire. And it's not the only thing that makes hominins distinctive, but it's one of the really preeminent things that makes us. The ability to consume energy through combustion is a power. It's a powerful thing that sets our species and our ancestors apart from, for instance, other great apes. So chimpanzees and gorillas that are some of our closest relatives are very confined to where they live. Chimpanzees live in tropical forests. They don't live in Arctic tundra and in semi-desert environments. Whereas humans can live almost anywhere on the planet. And fire is one of the big technological reasons why. Humans are powerful ecosystem engineers. We take landscapes and change them for our benefit. And fire is one of the tools that really allows us to do this. And we now have a very good understanding that hominins move around, they migrate, they wander. And Homo erectus is a wanderer. And these early archaic humans move out of our evolutionary birthplace in Central and Eastern Africa and migrate across Europe and Asia and occupy a huge range of ecosystems. Now, that's really interesting for the history of disease because infectious diseases are caused by microorganisms that live in the environment and in other animal populations. And so as our ancestors spread around the planet and occupied virtually every habitable niche on the planet, it also meant that we were exposed to new germs, to a much wider array of pathogens than we might have been if we were simply confined to one kind of ecosystem. So in a sense, our versatility as a species, which has a lot of benefits and upsides, also means that we occupy a range of different environments and are thereby exposed to a huge array of different diseases. And I think that's sometimes a part of the early formation of a distinctly hominin relationship with disease that we haven't always accounted for.
And you said that hominins move around, but obviously skipping forward in history, we give up this hunter-gatherer lifestyle where we're moving around looking for food to become farmers. So we're rooted to one spot of land and begin to domesticate animals. And what impact does that have on our health in terms of infectious disease?
Well, the transition to farming is, along with the transition to industrial capitalism in the modern world, is one of the two really fundamental changes in the way human beings live. So from the very origin of our species, which is maybe 250, 300,000 years ago, until about 10,000 years ago, we were hunter-gatherers. And hunter-gatherers move around a lot, and they take their food by finding it or killing it. And they have low population densities. And that's a really fundamental feature of their disease environments, that they're mobile and have low population densities. 10,000 years ago, there are probably only a few million humans on Earth. That makes us pretty successful for a primate, but nothing like what we are today, where there's nearly 8 billion humans. How do there get to be 8 billion humans? Well, the short answer is we figure out how to make food and not just take food from the environment. We domesticate plants and animals. This happens around a dozen times in different parts of the world. So there's not one singular moment. There's not one singular revolution. And this used to be called the Neolithic Revolution. We now understand that it's a very complex process, but it's one of the most fundamental transitions in human health as well. And it impacts human health in a range of different ways, changes in diet, changes in labor, but it absolutely transforms our disease environments. And the rise of farming sets in motion an acceleration of pathogen evolution and the construction of a really distinct human disease pool.
And that has to do, not to be too vulgar for our listeners, but a lot of that has to do with feces, doesn't it? Both from humans and from the animals that we're domesticating. How does that link to the rise of pathogens that are deadlier than ever?
You said it very well. You said it very well. I think it's important to step back and remind ourselves that the burden of diarrheal diseases and dysenteries on human societies is enormous. And we sometimes forget that in wealthy societies today. But even today, the access to clean water is one of the fundamental privileges that we enjoy that's not uniformly distributed around the world. And it's easy for us to forget how recently, even in Western Europe or the United States, the burden of diarrheal diseases and dysenteries was simply enormous. And throughout our entire history, since the rise of farming, this has been the case. One of the really important sources of sickness and death was the exposure to these kinds of diseases that transmit via fecal, contaminated fecal matter that enter drinking water or food supplies or simply are part of the domestic environment. And we forget that because of the amazing triumphs of public health and sanitation and hygiene in the late 19th and early 20th century. But in the past, these kinds of diseases were dangerous. Most of them aren't quite as famous. They don't have the sort of notorious names like plague and malaria that everybody knows for absolutely no good reason that I can think of. Shigellosis isn't a kind of household word, but it was one of the really terrible scourges throughout human history. And the reason why human societies have suffered such an extraordinary burden of these kinds of diseases is because of the environments that we created. When we gave up the hunter-gatherer lifestyle, we gave up the kind of extreme mobility that characterized those societies and took up sedentary life. We started living in permanent houses and permanent villages. And the consequence of that was that, frankly, we were surrounded by waste matter. And it turns out, not just the waste matter of ourselves, but also of our animals, domesticated animals. And the Neolithic villages that we created starting around 10,000 years ago, if you look at it from the perspective of a ecologist, are probably the single greatest accumulation of interspecies waste matter in all of nature. It's a really strange thing. And that's the ecological context that allows the evolution of so many different dangerous pathogens that cause diseases like bacillary dysentery, amoebic dysentery, typhoid, and other gastroenteric diseases.
And there's something else that I wanted to ask you about, which is insects. And there's one insect in particular, which is the mosquito, which plays quite a large role in your book. How is mosquitoes linked to the spreading of infectious diseases?
Well, vector-borne diseases are infectious diseases that are transmitted from human to human by the transport services of an unwitting insect vector, and or I should say arthropod vector. Some of these diseases are transmitted by ticks as well. And this is a really important means of transmission. And again, it's one that in very wealthy societies we're apt to underestimate. And that's really a kind of privilege that we take for granted, I think. But there's only so many ways a germ can get from one host to the next. Fecal oral route is one. Obviously, the respiratory route is another. So coughing, sneezing, droplets and aerosols that move from the respiratory tract of one person to the next. But the other really, really big one for human diseases is vector-borne transmission. And mosquitoes in particular play an enormous role in a huge range of really significant diseases, above all malaria. Malaria is the biggest of the big there, but there's a range of other vector-borne diseases caused by mosquitoes, like dengue fever and yellow fever, as well as others that are transmitted by lice, like typhus, which is a very important disease in human history. And these diseases are thus sort of shaped by the ecology of the insect vectors. And wherever the mosquitoes that can transmit disease are places that are often very seriously affected by infectious diseases. So I mentioned malaria. Malaria is one name for actually a number of closely related diseases that are caused by various species of Plasmodia parasites. There are two really big forms of malaria, vivax malaria, which is a very severe disease, and then falciparum malaria, which is one of the worst diseases that human societies have ever grappled with. And we forget, again, I think, how widespread some of these diseases are today and certainly have been throughout our past. For instance, you don't think, at least I don't think of England as a malarial place, but actually in some of the lowlands, the coastal kind of swampy coastal areas and fens actually used to have a fairly significant burden of malaria. It was never geographically hugely widespread, but in parts of Kent and Sussex and Essex, there were regions where the kind of saline, marshy areas supported the existence of a particular mosquito. It's an Anopheles mosquito, the species Atraparvus, that wherever that mosquito could live, malaria often really took hold and life expectancies were lower. It was really recognized that these places were somehow dangerous to live. And even the word malaria is Italian, but it means bad air. And in English, this used to be called mostly ague, so a kind of intermittent fever that's characterized by really intense chills followed by fever. It's easy for us to take for granted that we understand how these diseases pass from one person to another. But in the past, they really didn't. They kind of knew that there was an environmental dimension. They suspected there was something bad about the air. That's why it's called bad air. And that sort of swampy and wet places had damp and corrupt air that made people sick. And so there's an intuition there that's not completely wrong, that there's an environmental dimension to these diseases. But in the 19th century, the sort of riddle of why these environments supported the transmission of diseases is unlocked when a series of discoveries allows us to come to comprehend that these are in fact diseases that are caused by microbes that are transmitted by these vectors. So vector-borne transmission is very important, often in places where we don't think it was, and there are parallels in America too. We kind of forget that a lot of the Midwest, the Ohio and Mississippi River valleys, used to be pretty swampy, and those areas were places where malaria vectors, mosquitoes thrived, and human health was worse. It really impacted on human health until the advances of landscape drainage and eventually biomedical interventions helped us bring malaria under control. But I think we should never underestimate the power of vector-borne diseases, both in the past, but even still in much of the world, the present.
And thinking about progress, which is an overarching theme of your book, something that really interested me is it has a very complicated relationship with infectious disease. And you gave an example of the Roman Empire and said that the Roman Empire struggled a lot with infectious diseases, not because it was foundering, but because it was flourishing. How did progress aid the spread of infectious disease?
Well, now we're on pretty familiar territory for me. I'm a Roman historian by training, and actually that's how I got into this topic. As a Roman historian, it seemed evident to me that one of the really powerful factors in Roman history was the impact of a series of major pandemics that struck the Roman Empire. And there's a lot of evidence for these pandemics. And I sort of wanted to understand, why did these happen? Why now? And when you sort of stay within the boundaries of conventional academic history, I'm a Roman historian. If I do Roman history, then I can explore these pandemics. But I actually think there's a lot to be gained from zooming out. And that's certainly helped me, I think, understand what happens in the Roman Empire. And as you say, I think it's important to realize that sometimes infectious diseases emerge not because a society's already in crisis or as a kind of consequence of other kinds of misery or trouble, but actually infectious diseases thrive off the conditions of human social development. And really, from nature's perspective, that shouldn't maybe seem as paradoxical as it is, because infectious diseases are caused by infectious agents, by microparasites, whether viruses, bacteria, protozoa, even in some cases by fungi. And these are parasites that, like any organism in nature, they're They're just trying to pass on their genes. They of course, don't have intentions or consciousness. It's blind forces of evolution, but they're rewarded if they happen to be good at getting energy or taking over cells and passing their genes on to future generations. It's just evolution. And parasites benefit when their hosts benefit. And from nature's perspective, we are just hosts to our infectious diseases. And so when we multiply, when we create cities, when we create trade networks, it creates opportunities for our parasites. And so in the Roman case, we can see that in the second century, the height of the Roman Empire, what the great historian Edward Gibbon famously called the happiest age, it's kind of a phase when in certain ways a lot of things go right for the Roman Empire. There's lots of urbanization, the population multiplies. The Romans are trading with everybody. There's a huge trade in spices and aromatics and slaves and silk that connects the Roman Empire with Africa, with South Asia, even with East Asia. And in some ways, these very forces of urbanization, globalization in the Roman Empire create the conditions for them to be exposed to new pathogens and for infectious diseases to spread very rapidly within a highly interconnected Roman Empire. So I think for us, that seems paradoxical that the germs benefit from our success. But again, from an ecologist perspective, if we look at human history the way an ecologist might, we can perfectly well understand why it is that parasites benefit from, in this case, our species' success.
And one disease that really made the most of the trade networks, I mean, this is something that in your book you call a glamorous killer, which I very much enjoyed, as opposed to the more humdrum killers. And I wanted to ask you, because plague doesn't just come once, it will come again and again and again and keep rearing its head over a period of decades or centuries. And what did this effect of the disease continuing to outbreak and outbreak and outbreak, what did this do to society?
Right. Great way of framing the question. And as you were implying, there are bad infectious diseases and then there's plague. And we use plague sort of generically in English to mean pestilence. But here we're talking about the plague, which is a bacterial disease caused by the bacterium Yersinia pestis. It's an amazing disease, really, in every way. And there's a lot we know about it. It's one of the most studied diseases. And it's still mysterious in certain ways. I think there's a lot we don't really fully understand about plague and its history. But we benefit from a lot of new knowledge about this pathogen. And let me say first a little bit about why it's such a distinctive disease, because it's a zoonosis. It's an animal disease. It's really not a human disease. A disease like tuberculosis is a human disease. It can infect a few other animals, but we're the host. It specializes in us. In the case of plague, we're really an accident. We're totally irrelevant. It's a rodent disease, and it survives permanently in populations of wild burrowing rodents like marmots and jerboas and gerbils. It seems to have its evolutionary origins in the Central Asian steppe. And it's living perfectly happy as a disease of gerbils and so forth until it crosses paths with human societies. And the key to plague seems to be that it is spread by fleas. So it's also a vector-borne disease that's an animal disease that turns out to spread terribly efficiently in populations of black rats. And again, it's kind of easy for us, I think, today to fail to really intuitively understand how important these commensal rodents, these rodents that thrive on human habitats, have been throughout our past. So ancient and medieval villages and cities would have been just a paradise for black rats. And what's amazing about plague is that this disease, this bacterial disease that's spread by fleas in wild rodent populations, sort of explodes out of its natural habitats and reaches black rat populations that live everywhere around human habitations. And when that happens, it sparks these pandemics that are just mind-boggling in their spatial scale and in their impact. And I believe that if we look at the entire sweep of human history with disease, the big plague pandemics of the past are probably the single greatest shocks. They killed the most people over a really, really large territory of any disease that we know of. Now, the famous one, of course, is the Black Death that strikes in the 1340s. And we are learning so much about the deep history of plague. I mean, I could go on and on, but there's a lot of amazing science going on by archaeogeneticists, people who retrieve and study DNA from archaeological samples, from skeletons of victims. This was the first pathogen whose entire genome was sequenced from these ancient samples. It's a really amazing feat of laboratory science. And it helped us really nail down that the cause of the Black Death was Yersinia pestis. There'd been some doubt about that. It's also helped us write the deeper history of this pathogen, which seems to have been a part of the human story going back several thousand years. And certainly in the late Roman Empire, the 6th century, there's a massive pandemic known as the Plague of Justinian that in some ways is a parallel to the Black Death. But to go back to your question, which gets at something that's kind of new and really important, is that the Plague of Justinian, the Black Death in the 14th century are these huge mortality shocks that, I mean, you could study it for an entire lifetime and I think still be find it mind-boggling. But it's important to realize that that's just the beginning. And plague doesn't just strike once and then disappear. It lurks and then it recurs. And it's really important to try to account for these recurrent episodes of plague. So the second pandemic is the name we give to the really long series of plague outbreaks that starts with the Black Death, but lasts in Western Europe down to really the late 17th century. There's a confined outbreak in the early 18th century. In the Eastern Mediterranean, the Near East, it lasts even longer. So we're talking about 400 or 500 years. And really right down to the end of the pandemic, the plague is the most forceful infectious disease. There are a lot of other nasty diseases, but plague is plague. And we really know this from a richer documentary record than you might think. So even in, for instance, 17th century London, where we have some pretty amazing public records known as the Bills of Mortality, where without our modern concepts of germs or the same disease categories we have, they're trying to tabulate how everybody dies. And these are really important. They're imperfect, but they're really important records to have some sense of what diseases are out there. And you can kind of translate them to get at least a crude picture. And the story they tell about plague is pretty remarkable. In the 17th century in London, which is a pretty amazing place, the plague is responsible for all of the worst mortality outbreaks. And so a series of plague outbreaks about once a generation that ends in 1665, the Great Plague. They didn't know it at the time, but it was in fact the last time that there would be a major plague outbreak in London. But we do have some records that help us see that there's a lot of diseases on the horizon in pre-modern societies, but plague really stands out. When this rodent disease gets a hold of our black rats and the fleas start jumping from rats to humans, it was a terrifying thing, like really nothing else.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Cities are places where people try to figure out how to live together. They don't understand the microbial causes of disease, but our forebears were clever in their own ways. And they knew that that sanitary regulations promoted health. They, you know, your nose isn't the worst guide to what's dirty and dangerous.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
I'm moving on now to think about the modern Atlantic era. So European travelers go over to the Americas and the Eastern and the Western hemispheres are reunited. So this is a key milestone in globalization, but also in the globalization of disease. How much of a factor do you think the spreading of disease was in the decimation of indigenous peoples?
Well, I think it's a really important question. And it's one that's become controversial because there was an earlier generation of historians in the 60s, 70s, and 80s that may have, for one, overestimated the scale of New World societies, their populations, and two, may have been a little monocausal in saying, look, smallpox came and spread like wildfire, even faster than the Europeans could. And there was sort of a reaction to that by historians in the 90s and early 2000s that was very healthy to say it really wasn't the infectious diseases alone, but infectious diseases in the greater context of European colonization and extraction of metal resources and eventually the formation of plantation societies. And so I think that balance is healthy, but I do believe it's important to really underscore the importance of trying to understand the period of European expansion across the Atlantic in two ways. One is to really recognize, as we've known, that the biological dimensions of this encounter are really important. The sudden introduction of not just one or two, but an entire array of really, really significant pathogens like smallpox and measles and diphtheria and mumps all at once was very much part of the encounter. And the written sources, both from Europeans and Native American societies, are really insistent about that one of the fundamental dynamics of this encounter is the fact that old world societies had more diseases and different diseases than new world societies. And that imbalance played into the power dynamics. And the reasons for that are really due to the history and the ecology of old world diseases. There are reasons why the existence of some of these pathogens in the old world had developed. Now, secondly, though, I think we've kind of known that piece of the story. We're learning new things about it. Still, there's an important archaeogenetic study in the last couple of years that showed that in one population in central southern Mexico, where there was clearly a mass mortality in the middle of the 1540s that we know well from written sources, that one of the pathogens that really popped out when the DNA was sequenced was paratyphoid fever. That is not usually given top billing in the kind of story of European germs, which usually focuses on smallpox. And so that's interesting, too, because it reminds us that it wasn't just the introduction of one or two germs. It was a lot of germs. And again, these fecal-oral pathogens that transmit in feces that infect water and food were really important. But I think it's important we also try to zoom out and not just focus on Europeans bringing a handful of respiratory and diarrheal diseases, but to see this really in global perspective. And that includes the encounters between Europeans and Africans and New World environments. And one of the really important things that happens in this period is that particularly tropical crops, so plants, as well as pests, from the tropics, both insect pests, but also microbial ones, are transferred via the slave trade and the systems of plantation agriculture and the exchange networks that they created and required, help transfer pathogens from the old world tropics, largely from equatorial Africa, to the new world environments, particularly South America, the Caribbean, and the very southern United States. And this probably doesn't kind of have the same place in our public consciousness that, say, the arrival of smallpox does. But the transfer of yellow fever and malaria, which are tropical diseases, to the new world is, in the long run, just as important in the formation of a disease environment and shaping human health and demography. And that's even not the only way in which I think it's important to try and see these diseases in global perspective. It's worth pointing out that the first smallpox pandemic in the New World that we know of, 1518, 1519, the following years, is a very, very serious and deadly event. But amazingly, smallpox got to be a bigger problem basically everywhere in the world right at this time. And so it's kind of wrong to focus on just that, you know, smallpox arriving in Mexico and not see that smallpox is a terrific force of destruction in Ming China at exactly the same time. So I think globalization is exactly the right word to use, and to try and put that important encounter between European societies and the New World into this bigger perspective, in which what really takes off in many ways from the 16th century is just a new age of globalization in general.
And you mentioned earlier in the conversation the rise of cities, and this is something I really wanted to find out more about. What does the creation of the modern city, what effect does that have on infectious disease?
Well, cities are a huge part of the story of human disease because they bring people together. They bring people together, and so they're sharing space, they're sharing air, they're sharing water, they're sharing sewage space, they're sharing insects, they're sharing lice and fleas. And cities were really deadly places. There's just a lot of evidence from a lot of different parts of the world that country life was healthier. People in the country lived longer. They grew taller. They bore less of a burden of infectious disease. But cities still drew migrants. They were economic magnets. They're culturally exciting throughout most of our past as they are now. And so even though there was a huge penalty to pay in terms of health and mortality, cities drew people and ended up being a demographic sink and creating a kind of place where people would go and disproportionately would die. And really no ancient or medieval or even early modern city could reproduce itself. Its death rates were always higher than birth rates. So they relied on the constant influx of people. But infectious diseases thrived in cities. Diseases of waste like typhoid, diseases of the respiratory tract like tuberculosis. And so there's a really important dynamic in human history in which cities allow the evolution and circulation of diseases, and which they create really strong demographic differences between the town and the countryside. But I also want to say cities are places of innovation. And that's a very deep part of the human story. And I think we can recognize that already in antiquity, in ancient Greece and Rome, for instance, cities are places where people try to figure out how to live together. They don't understand the microbial causes of disease, but our forebears were clever in their own ways. And they knew that that sanitary regulations promoted health. Your nose isn't the worst guide to what's dirty and dangerous. And throughout the late Middle Ages in particular, there are amazing efforts to create more sanitary environments. Even so, the capacity of towns and governments to do so was limited relative to the modern city. And to make a long story short, what happens in the modern period behind the forces of the Industrial Revolution is really intense urbanization in the early 19th century. And this actually, for a time, is such an overwhelming force that it sort of stalls the improvements in health and life expectancy overall in much of the early industrializing world between 1800 and 1850. Human health, on average, doesn't get much better, even though there are important discoveries and advances that are happening. Moving in the other direction is the fact that people are moving to cities that are where housing is often unregulated, where the supply of fresh water is limited or non-existent. But over the 19th, and particularly from the mid to late 19th century, there's a series of really rapid innovations in technology, but particularly in policy, that allow cities to become much healthier places. And so from the regulation of housing and labor to, above all, the provision of clean water and public sewage systems that remove waste from the human environment proved to be absolutely revolutionary. So there is an important story in which technology and policy come together in the later 19th century to catalyze the rise of much, much cleaner cities.
And then we have this concept that you refer to called the Great Escape, which is where societies start making profits and also people's life expectancies start going up rapidly, so they more than double. What causes this? Do they cause each other, or is something else at play?
Well, I borrow the term Great Escape. It's the title of a book by an economist named Angus Deaton, who wrote a wonderful study of this phenomenon. And it really entails two things that have happened globally since 1750. And this is zooming out very much, but the average human life expectancy has more than doubled. And human populations are vastly wealthier than they used to be. And to me, this is one of the great questions of history. How did that happen? Down to 1750, there have been no improvements in human life expectancy throughout the entire history of our species. Down to about 1750, there have been very modest improvements in human prosperity. Most people in pre-modern times were by our standards, extremely poor. And modernity achieves a level of economic growth and prolongation of human life that is one of the great questions of history, is to say how did that happen. And it's a big story. There's lots of dimensions to it, but I try to tell the story in terms of two forces that really allowed humans to gain control of infectious disease, and it's science and statecraft. It's the rapidly accelerating discoveries that began with the Enlightenment and the rise of empirical science that allow ever greater control and understanding of infectious disease. And so just to pinpoint one moment from the background of a much broader series of transformative discoveries. Think of Edward Jenner's publication in 1798 about vaccination. People had sort of started to intuit that there were possibilities here, but he was really the one who brought it all together. And in 1798, he publishes the results of his studies of what happens when you intentionally infect someone with cowpox in order to prevent them from being infected by smallpox, which is at that time, the worst disease in England and much of Western Europe and the United States. Is a unfathomably terrible disease. And Jenner's publication on smallpox, Thomas Jefferson, the American president, called it the discovery of the single greatest utility in the history of medicine. And up to that time, I think he was right. I think smallpox did more to improve the human condition and control of infectious disease. And that's an example of science. And then you can think about the progressive discovery of microbes and the more systematic invention of vaccines, ultimately pharmaceuticals and insecticides, other forms of clinical care that have improved outcomes and reduced the burden of infectious disease. But The flip side of that story, I think, is what we can call really broadly statecraft, because scientific discovery by itself doesn't improve human health. It has to affect behavior and culture and institutions. And it's really that combination of good science with good policy, with behavioral and social adaptations that help bring infectious diseases under control. So just stick with the story of smallpox. Edward Jenner shows in 1798 that vaccination works. But smallpox doesn't go away immediately. It mortality is directly reduced, but over the course of the 19th century, this happens in Britain and ultimately happens in the United States. You have to convince people that smallpox vaccination works. You have to embed it in systems of delivery where they can get vaccination. And ultimately, frankly, societies had to require vaccination. It was made compulsory. And the scope and power of the state and its ability to compel citizens to do things, frankly, whether they wanted to or not, was fundamental to achieving control over that disease. So that's just one example of the bigger story of how it's improvements in knowledge that allow prevention and treatment, and improvements in statecraft, which we can think of as a whole array of social adaptations that allow humans to gain the upper hand, but never completely vanquish the challenges of infectious disease.
Of course, we know that all too well at the moment, sadly. And before we come on to that, I thought, when am I going to have an opportunity to ask someone who's written a book about the entire history of disease? Open my mind to some very horrible worms. But I wanted to ask you, what is an epidemic or a disease that is completely overlooked by us now that you wish we all knew more about?
Well, I've already gone on about diarrheal diseases, so I'll leave that to the side. But you know, I did write a whole chapter about the germs that used to lurk in human poop. So clearly, that's a kind of hobby horse that I have strong feelings about. We just get so obsessed with the plague and the big respiratory infections that they kind of get left out. But yeah, you said worms, and I think that's probably what I'd want to answer. And the burden of disease from soil transmitted worms like helminths, such as hookworm, that have been really one of the great diseases of history. They aren't quick killers, so they're not quite as dramatic, but they really are parasites that drain energy and possibility from human beings. And so hookworm is one of the really big overlooked diseases. The other one that I spent some time on in the book is schistosomiasis, which is, you know, just hard to say. And so it doesn't get the, you know, maybe attention or celebrity that it deserves. But it's also a worm disease that's one of those that's sort of out there and just doesn't have the place in consciousness. So one of the things I try to do in the book, and I'm hoping to the best of my ability, that it's trying to be a global history. And so this isn't just about the diseases of Western Europe. I think that's a very blinkered view and makes it hard to really understand the history of human health. And part of that means changing the diseases that you talk about. So this, obviously, smallpox and plague are biggies. There's no doubt about that. And I think we have to give them their due. But if we broaden the lens and talk more about malaria, which is a pretty obvious one, but even some of these diseases like hookworm and yellow fever and schistosomiasis and lymphatic filariasis that are really important human diseases that just... They don't have the same celebrity. For various reasons, a lot of it has to do that either they never were a major burden in Western Europe and the United States, or they were eradicated so early that they don't have the kind of dramatic power for us. But I've tried to make some of these obscure diseases a little more interesting and to explain why they're really important.
So we mentioned COVID-19, which is where I'd like us to leave the discussion. As a historian of disease, was COVID-19 inevitable? And do you think we'll have future pandemics? Is this something we should be getting used to?
Well, it's a question I get asked a lot. And I'm a historian, so I like to have a few thousand years perspective before I form an opinion. I will say I started writing this book in 2017. And it was framed as in part as a warning. And I wanted it to say, look, infectious diseases are caused by microorganisms that exist because of evolution. And nature never stops. Evolution never stops. And we should see that the modern period is in many ways defined by this triumphant achievement, the achievements of doubling, more than doubling global life expectancy and changing the stability of life, the reduction of pain, suffering, and death because of science and statecraft is miraculous. But we didn't just come along and wipe all of these infectious diseases off the face of the earth forever. In fact, I would say one of the important perspectives that a deep history of disease can give us is that we achieved these triumphs against an ever-escalating threat of infectious disease. As we've multiplied and our cities have gotten bigger and we created fossil fuel-driven transport, diseases have emerged constantly. New ones and old ones, cholera, plague, the great influenza, polio, AIDS. So the last two centuries have just been full of examples of really, really nasty new or resurgent diseases that we've often failed to control, sometimes partly controlled, and in the last generation had largely managed to dodge some bullets and to avoid some disasters, but had several close calls, including with several coronaviruses. And so was it inevitable in some shape or form? Yes. There are microbes that are trying to adapt to the human host. And the evolution of a respiratory virus was one of the, I think, most foreseeable kinds of outcome. Viruses that travel via the respiratory tract are able to take advantage of our global connectivity. Viruses mutate very quickly, so they're sort of evolutionary superstars. They're always trying nasty things. And there's more humans intruding on more ecosystems that are more interconnected, that are abusing more and different kinds of animals than at any time in the past. And so coronaviruses had already been kind of knocking at the door. SARS-1 was a wake-up call, and we were warned. Public health experts, microbiologists, specialists in emerging infectious diseases told us, be prepared. In 1991 in America, the Institute of Medicine issued a blue ribbon panel to sound the alarm bell. We've been warned for a long time, and we were complacent. And unfortunately, we were not up to the meeting the challenge of COVID-19 in many ways. I think with perspective, there have been some remarkable successes in the story of COVID-19, above all on the technical side, the invention of three really safe and really effective vaccines in less than a year is a marvel. But I think on the social side, the response has been wanting. But again, I'm a historian. I like to have a little more perspective. There's only a couple of pages on COVID in the book because this really wasn't originally born as a COVID book. Obviously, I was about halfway done when COVID started, and I worked like crazy to do my best to finish it. Because it became urgent in a way I hadn't anticipated. And I do hope that history isn't a tea leaves that tell us the future, but it tells us how we got here. And it, I think, can shape the way we understand the threats that face us, and hopefully can give us a deeper sense of how important global health is and why we need to be preparing ourselves for the next one. COVID's not over, but even when it is, it won't be the last time that we face a novel infectious disease.
That was Kyle Harper. His new book, Plagues Upon the Earth, Disease and the Course of Human History, is out in the UK, published by Princeton University Press. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Join us again tomorrow when I'll be speaking to Nick Baker and John Wolfe about the surprising secrets of Edwardian Britain.